3. Later, Clint would reflect that he should have known Peters was up to something. The officer was too placid at first, the smile on his face entirely inappropriate to the charges being leveled. Clint was angry, though, angry as he hadn't been since he was Jared's age, and he didn't see what he should have seen. It was as if there was a rope in his head, binding shut a box containing a lot of bad stuff from his childhood. His wife's lie had been the first cut in the fiber, Aurora had been the second, the interview with Evie had been the third, and what had happened to Jeanette had snapped it. He found himself considering the damage he could inflict on Peters with various objects. He could shatter his nose with the phone on the desk. He could cave in the abusing fuck's cheek with the warden's Correctional Official of the Year plaque. Clint had worked hard to exorcise that kind of violent thinking, had largely gone into psychiatric medicine in the first place in reaction to it. What had Shannon said that time? "Clint, sweetie, if you keep fighting, someday you're gonna win too good." She'd meant that he'd kill someone, and maybe she had been right. It wasn't much later that the court granted him his independence, and Clint didn't have to fight anymore. After that, his senior year, he had consciously funneled his rage into running track. That had been Shannon's idea, too, and a damn good one. "You want to exercise," she had said. "You should run. There's less bleeding." He'd run from that old life. Run like the gingerbread man, run all the way to medical school, to marriage, to fatherhood. Most of the system kids didn't make it. Foster care was a true case of odds against. Many of them had ended up in jailhouses like Dueling Correctional or Lionhead Prison up the road, which, according to the engineers, was in danger of sliding down the hill. Indeed, there were plenty of system girls in Dueling, and they lived at the mercy of Don Peters. Clint had been lucky. He had beaten the odds. Shan had helped him. He hadn't thought of her in a long while. But this day was like a broken water main. There was stuff coming up, a flood in the streets. It seemed that days of disaster were also days of remembering. 4. Clinton Richard Norcross had entered the foster system for good in 1974, when he was 6. But the records he'd seen later said he'd been in and out even before that. A typical story. Teenage parents, drugs, poverty, criminal records, probably mental health issues. The nameless social worker that interviewed Clint's mother had recorded, "She is worried about passing her sad feelings along to her son." He had no memories of his father, and the only scrap he retained of his mother was of a long-faced girl grabbing his hands, swallowing them up in hers, shaking them up and down, pleading to him to stop chewing his nails. Lila had asked him once if he was interested in attempting to make contact with either of them, if they were alive. Clint was not. Lila said she understood, but really she had no idea, and he liked it that way. He didn't want her to. The man she married, the cool and able Dr. Clinton Norcross, had, quite consciously, put that abandoned life behind him. Except you couldn't put anything behind you. Nothing was lost until death or Alzheimer's took it all. He knew that. He saw it confirmed in every session he held with every prisoner. You wore your history like a necklace, a smelly one made of garlic. Whether you tucked it under your collar or let it dangle loose, nothing was lost. You fought the fight over and over, and you never won the milkshake. He had passed through half-dozen homes during his youth and adolescence. None of them like a home, if that meant a place where you felt safe. Perhaps it was no wonder that he had ended up working in a penitentiary. The feelings in prison were the feelings of his youth and young adulthood, a sense of being always on the verge of suffocation. He wanted to help people who felt that way, because he knew how bad it was, how it struck at the center of your humanity. That was the core of Clint's decision to leave his private practice before it had really started. There were good foster homes out there, more than ever in this day and age, but Clint had never landed in any. The best he could say was that a few had been clean, run by foster parents who were efficient and unobtrusive, doing only what was required to collect their fee from the state. They were forgettable. But forgettable was great. You'd take forgettable. The worst were the worst in particular ways. The places where there wasn't enough to eat. The places where the rooms were cramped and dirty and cold in the winter. Where the parents had non-paying jobs for you. The places where they hurt you. Girls in the system got hurt the most. Of course they did. Some of his foster siblings, Clint couldn't find their faces now, but a few remained clear. There was Jason, for instance, who killed himself at 13 by drinking a bottle of off-brand drain cleaner. Clint could summon up live Jason, and he could summon up dead Jason, lying in his coffin. That was when Clint had lived with Dermot and Lucille Bertel, who boarded their fosters not in their pretty Cape Cod house, but in a long shed-like structure out back with bare, splintery plywood floors and no insulation. The Bertels held what they called Friday night fights, with their half-dozen wards as the pugilists and a chocolate milkshake from McDonald's for the prize. Clint and Jason had been matched up once, fighting for the amusement of the Bertels and their friends. The arena was a little patch of broken-up concrete patio, and the spectators gathered around the edge to watch and lay bets. Jason had been a long shot, scared and slow, and Clint had wanted that milkshake. In the open casket, Jason had a nickel-sized bruise under his eye that Clint had given him a few evenings earlier. The next Friday, after Jason drank Gunko and retired from boxing forever, Clint won the milkshake again, and then, without thinking about any possible consequences, at least not that he could remember, he threw it in Dermot Bertel's face. That had resulted in a tremendous beating for Clint, and it hadn't brought Jason back, but it had gotten him out of that house. At the next place, or maybe the one after that, was where he'd shared a dismal basement room with good old Marcus. Clint remembered his foster brother Marcus's wonderful cartoons. Marcus drew people so that they were 80% nose, pretty much just noses with wee legs and wee arms. The nose-it-alls was what he called his strip. He was really good, and dedicated, too. Then one day after school, without any explanation, Marcus told Clint he'd thrown all his notebooks away somewhere, and he was lighting out. Clint could picture the cartoons, but not Marcus. Shannon, though. Shannon he could see. She was too beautiful to fade. "Hey, I'm Shannon. Don't you want to know me?" She introduced herself that way without glancing over at Clint, who was walking past on his way to the park, sunbathing across the hood of a Buick that was parked at the curb outside the group home in Wheeling, blue tank top and black jeans, and smiling right up into the sun. "You're Clint, aren't you?" "Yeah," he said. "Uh-huh. Well, isn't it nice to meet us?" she replied. And Clint, despite everything, had laughed, really laughed, for the first time in who knew how long. The group home in Wheeling where he met her was the last stop on his grand tour of the state foster system. For most, it was basically a connecting point to places like Doolin Correctional and Weston State. Weston, a monumental Gothic asylum, closed in 1994. Now, in 2017, it was open for ghost tours. Was that where his father ended up? Clint wondered. His mother? Or Richie, who got his nose and three fingers broken by some prep school boys in a mall because he said they shouldn't make fun of his purple jacket that had come from a donation box. Or Marcus. He knew they couldn't all be dead or in prison, and yet it didn't seem like any of them could still be breathing and free. Did they all float around the dark halls of Weston after hours? Did they ever talk about Clint? Were they glad for him? Or did he shame them by still living? 5. The Wheeling home was preferable to many of the stops that had preceded it. The sneering administrator, thumbs popping the pockets of his gray polyester vest, admonished each new arrival. "Enjoy your last year on the state's tit, yonker!" But he, the sneering administrator, didn't want any trouble. So long as you managed not to get arrested, he let you sign in and out all day long. You could fight, fuck, or shoot up. Just keep it out of the house, yonker. He and Shan were both 17 then. She had taken notice of Clint's reading habit, how he slipped off to a park down the street and sat on a bench to catch up on his homework, despite the cold late fall weather. Shannon had also seen the bloody scrapes on his hands from the trouble he found, and sometimes searched for, between the home and school. They got to be friends. She gave him advice. Most of it was good. "You've almost made it out, you know," she said. "Just need to keep from killing anyone a little while longer," she said. "Let your brain make you rich," she said. Shan spoke as if the world didn't matter too much to her, and somehow that made Clint want to make it matter, to her, to himself. He went out for track and stopped fighting. That was the short version. The long one was Shannon, Shannon in the sun, Shannon prodding him to run faster, to apply for scholarships, to stick to his books and stay off the sidewalks. Shannon at night, jimmying the lock on the door of the boys' floor with a celluloid-backed playing card, the Queen of Spades, and slipping into Clint's room. "Hey now," she said at the sight of him in his team uniform, tank top and high shorts. "If I ruled the world, all the boys would have to wear shorts like that." Shannon had been gorgeous, and she'd been clever, and she had her own boatload of problems, and Clint thought maybe she'd saved his life. He went to college. She advised him to go, and when he hesitated, talking about the army, she demanded. She said, "Don't be no fool. Get your ass to school." He did, and they fell out of touch. Phone calls too expensive and letters too time-consuming. It was 8 or 9 years between when he left for college before they reconnected that New Year's in D.C. 2001? 2002? He'd been in town to attend a seminar at Georgetown and stayed on for a night because of car trouble. Lila had told him he was allowed to go out and get drunk, but he was forbidden to kiss any desperate women. He could kiss a desperate man if he absolutely had to, but no more than one. The bar where he'd run into Shan was boiling with college kids. She was waitressing. "Hey, pal," she said to Clint, stepping up beside him at the bar, bumping him with her hip. "I used to know a guy in the joint who looked just like you." They had embraced for a long time, swaying back and forth in each other's arms. She looked tired, but she seemed all right. They managed to get a minute alone in a corner underneath a flashing Molson sign. "Where y'all?" she had asked. "Out in the sticks, Tri-Counties, place called Dooling, a day's drive from here. It's a beauty spot." He had shown her a photo of 4-month-old Jared. "Oh, look at him. Now wasn't it all worth it, Clint? I need to get me one of those." Dew shone on Shannon's eyelashes. People were screaming all around them. It was almost a new year. "Hey," he'd said to her. "Hey, it's all right." She had looked up at him, and the years had narrowed, and it was like they were kids again. "Is it?" Shannon asked. "Is it all right, Clint?" 6. Over the warden's shoulder, on the other side of the glass, late afternoon shadows were staining the garden, where there were rows of lettuce and peas climbing trellises built of scrap wood. Coates cupped her hands around her coffee cup as she spoke. The coffee cup. Clint could upend it on Dom Peters's crotch and then smash it against his ear. There was a time before he knew Shannon Parks when he would have done so. He reminded himself that he was a father and a husband, a doctor, a man with too much gray in his hair to fall into the trap of violence. Sometime soon he was going to clock out and go home to his wife, his son, and a nice view out the glass doors to a pool in the backyard. Fighting for milkshakes had been in another life. Still, he wondered what that coffee cup was made of, if it was that heavy ceramic that sometimes didn't even crack when you dropped it on hard tile. "You're taking this rather well," observed Janice Coates. Peters brushed a finger along his mustache. "I'm just enjoying thinking about how my lawyer is going to make me a millionaire off this wrongful firing, Warden. I think I'll buy a boat. Also, I was raised to be a gentleman no matter how I was mistreated. So fire me. Fine, but you got no proof. I'm gonna roll you up in court." He glanced at Clint, who was standing by the door. "You okay? I see you standing there and making fists. You need to pinch a loaf or something, Doc?" "Fuck you," Clint said. "See, that's not nice," said Peters, smiling, showing teeth the color of shoe peg corn. Coates sipped from the coffee cup she'd just refilled. It was bitter. She took another sip anyway. She was feeling optimistic. The day was an apocalypse, but her daughter was driving home, and she was finally ridding herself of Don Peters. Amid the fecal mounds, there occasionally glimmered a pearl or two of satisfaction. "You're a scumbag, and you're lucky we can't deal with you to the extent you deserve right now." From the pocket of her suit jacket, she produced a baggie. She held it up and gave it a shake. Inside the baggie were two Q-tips. "Because, you see, we do have proof." Peters's grin faltered, tried to come on strong, didn't quite make it. "It's your squirt, Donny boy, from the Coke machine." Coates took a big swig of the lousy coffee and smacked her lips. "Once everything settles down and we can deal with you as you deserve, you're going to jail. Good news is they keep the sex offenders in a special wing, so you might survive. But the bad news is, even with a good lawyer, you'll be in there for quite a while. Don't worry, though, you'll still get to see me at your parole hearings. I'm on the board, you know." The warden twisted to her intercom and pressed the call button. "Blanche, can you rustle up a fresh bag of coffee? This stuff is dreadful." She waited a moment for a response and then pressed the button again. "Blanche?" Coates released the button. She must have stepped out. Coates returned her attention to Peters on the couch. His grin had given up entirely. The officer was breathing hard, running his tongue around under his lips, clearly working through the implications of the DNA evidence that had just been waved in his face. "For now," the warden said, "just turn in your uniform and bug out. Telling you we have the goods on you is probably a mistake on my part, but I couldn't resist the opportunity to gloat. It gives you a few extra days until the hammer falls. You could hop in your car, head for Canada. Who knows, maybe you can keep your head down, become an ice fisherman." "Set up!" Peters leaped to his feet. "This is a setup!" Clint could no longer hold back. He stepped forward, grabbed the shorter man by the throat, and pushed him against the wall. Don batted at Clint's shoulders and face, scraping Clint's cheeks with his nails. Clint squeezed. Under his fingers, Clint could feel Peters's pulse squirming, could feel his Adam's apple shrinking, could feel the impossibility and frustration and fright of the entire day pooling out around his hands like juice from a grapefruit. A moth was fluttering around his head. It planted a ghost kiss on one temple and was gone. "Dr. Norcross!" Clint drove a fist into the soft sack of Peters's belly and then let go. The officer fell onto the couch and slid off, onto the floor on his hands and knees. He made a choked animal noise.
He.
The warden's door banged open. Tig Murphy stepped in, holding a taser. Damp glistened on Tig's cheeks and his color was poor. He told Clint he was fine, but he wasn't fine. Nothing was fine, and nobody was fine.
He.
Peters began to crawl away from Clint. The moth had lost interest in Clint, and now it was circling the crawling man, seemingly ushering him out.
"We were just going to call for you, Officer Murphy."
Coates, still at her desk, proceeded as if nothing had happened at all.
"Mr. Peters was about to exit the premises, and he tripped over a fold in the rug. Help him up, would you? He can leave his things in the locker room."
The warden toasted Tig Murphy with her coffee cup and drank it down. Chapter 12 1.
"Now, officer, you know I'm prone to fits of temper, right?"
Angel, standing at a respectful distance from the booth, presented this rhetorical question to Vanessa Lampley. Jeanette, beside her, had no illusions. They were facing an uphill battle. Behind the plastic shield of the booth, seated at the board, Lampley's broad shoulders were curled dangerously forward. She looked prepared to leap straight through the shield. Jeanette figured that in a fight, Angel could dish out plenty despite her narrow frame, but not enough to handle Lampley.
"Fitzroy, is that some kind of half-assed threat? With the shit that's going on today? Now, I got 3 inmates covered in cobwebs. I'm way past when I should have clocked out. I'm weary as hell, and you want to test me? That is a bad idea, I promise you."
Angel held up her palms.
No, officer. I'm just saying, I wouldn't trust me in a situation like this either, okay? My felony record speaks for itself, and there's lots else I got away with. Though you understand I can't share specifics.
Jeanette touched her forehead and studied the ground. If there had ever been a plan for Angel, post-parole, to move into the area of international diplomacy, someone needed to revamp it.
Get out of here, you fucking nitwit, Lampley said. Which is why I brought Jeanette.
With this, Angel threw out an arm.
Ta-da!
Well, that changes everything.
Don't mock.
The arm that Angel had raised dropped to her side. What had been collegial in her expression flattened.
Don't you mock me, officer.
Don't you don't me, inmate. Jeanette decided it was now or never. Officer Lampley, I'm sorry, we're not trying to make any trouble. Van, who had started to rise imposingly from her chair, settled back. Unlike Fitzroy, who basically lived on bad report, owning it like a damn property in Monopoly, Sorley was known for her friendly attitude. And according to Reed Dempster, Sorley had been molested by that poisonous toad, Peters. Van supposed she could hear her out.
What is it?
We want to cook up some coffee, some special coffee, to help everyone stay awake. Van held her finger on the intercom for a second or two before she spoke, then asked the obvious.
What do you mean by special?
Stronger than regular coffee, Jeanette said.
You can have some, too,
Angel said, and tried for a magnanimous smile.
It'll sharp you right up.
Oh, that's just what I need. A whole prison full of hopped-up inmates. That would be wonderful. Let me guess, Fitzroy. The secret ingredient is crack cocaine.
Well, not exactly, since we don't have any. And let me ask you this. What's the alternative?
Lampley admitted she didn't know. Jeanette spoke up. Officer, unless this Aurora gets solved pronto, people in here are going to get restless. This fully dawned on her, even as she articulated it. Except for Maura Dunbarton and a couple of other lifers, there was at least a distant beacon of hope, the end of their sentence. Freedom. For all intents and purposes, the Aurora flu was a sudden dousing of that hope. No one knew what came after sleep, or if anything did. It was like heaven that way.
They're going to get worried, and they're going to get upset and scared, and you could have a serious problem.
Jeanette was careful not to employ the word riot, but that was the problem she was envisioning.
They're already worried and upset and scared. You said it yourself, there's already been three of us that have come down with this thing, and we got the ingredients right in the kitchen. You just have to let us in and we'll do the rest. Look, I'm not trying to be pushy here or cause a ruckus. You know me, right? I try to get along. My time has been clean. I'm just telling you what my concern is and proposing an idea.
And your special coffee is going to fix that? Some accelerant is going to make everyone copacetic with the situation?
No, officer, said Jeanette. That is not what I think.
Lampley's hand found her bicep tattoo of the gravestone, your pride. She let her fingers wander over the lines. The focus of her gaze drifted up to something above the screen of the booth. A clock, Jeanette thought. Most likely there's a clock hanging there. Lampley was morning shift. She probably went to bed around 9 to get up at 5 or 5:30 a.m. and drive to work. From the clock in her cell, Jeanette knew it was around 5 p.m. now. Getting late. The officer rolled her head around on her thick neck. There were circles under her eyes, Jeanette noticed. That was what a double shift did to you.
Fuck, said Lampley.
Jeanette couldn't hear it through the soundproofed barrier, but she saw the officer mouth it. Lampley leaned back into the intercom.
Tell me more, inmate. Sell me. I think it'll give everyone a little hope, make them feel like they're doing something, and buy a little extra time for this thing to blow over.
Van's gaze darted upward again. The discussion went on for a while longer, eventually turning into a negotiation and finally into a plan. But that was the moment when Jeanette knew she'd won Officer Lampley over. There was no denying the clock. 2.
Clint and Coates had the warden's office to themselves again, but at first neither of them spoke. Clint had gotten his breath back, but his heart was still going bang, bang, bang. And he guessed his blood pressure, borderline at his last physical, a fact he had neglected to share with Lila, no need to worry her, she had enough on her plate, was redlining. "Thanks," he said.
"For what?"
"Covering for me." She knuckled her eyes. To Clint, she looked like a tired child back from a playdate that had gone on too long.
"I just got rid of the bad apple in our basket, Doc. That had to be done, but I'm not getting rid of anyone else, not when I'm already short-handed. At least everyone else has stayed on so far."
Clint opened his mouth to say, "I wanted to kill him," closed it again.
"I will say,"
Janice opened her mouth in a jaw-cracking yawn,
"that I was a little surprised. You went after him like Hulk Hogan back in his steroid-assisted heyday."
Clint lowered his head.
"But I need you for at least the time being. My assistant warden is AWOL again, so you get the job until Hicks turns up."
"I imagine he went home to check on his wife."
"I imagine he did too, and while I understand, I don't approve. We've got over 100 women locked up in here. Those women have to be our priority. I don't need you losing your grip."
"I'm not."
"I hope that's true. I know you come from a difficult background. I've read your file. But there's nothing in there about a talent for choking people to death. Of course, juvenile records get sealed."
Clint forced himself to meet the warden's eyes.
"That's right. They do. Tell me what I just saw with Peters was an aberration."
"It was an aberration."
"Tell me you'd never lose it that way with one of the women. Fitzroy, for instance. Or one of the others. The new one, maybe. Evie the weirdo."
Clint's shocked expression must have been answer enough for her, because she smiled. As it turned into another yawn, her phone rang.
"Warden?"
She listened.
"Vanessa, why are you calling me when you have a perfectly good intercom at your dispo—"
She listened some more, and as she did, Clint observed a queer thing. The phone kept sliding up from her ear and toward her hairline. She'd bring it down, and then it would start that upward journey again. It could be simple tiredness, but it didn't exactly look like tiredness. He wondered briefly if Janice had a bottle in her desk, and dismissed the idea. He and Lila had been out to dinner with Coates a few times, and he'd never seen her order anything stronger than a glass of wine, which she usually left unfinished. He told himself to stop jumping at shadows, but that was hard to do. If Warden Coates went down, who would that leave until Hixie got back? If Hixie got back. Lampley? Him? Clint thought about what it would be like to become acting warden and had to suppress a shudder.
"Okay,"
Coates said into the phone. Listened.
"Okay," I said. "Yes, let them do it. Go ahead and put it on the intercom. Tell Jen Pop that the coffee wagon will be rolling."
She ended the call, tried to put the phone back in the cradle, missed, and had to do it again.
"Shoot,"
she said, and laughed. "Janice, are you all right?"
"Oh, couldn't be better," she said.
But couldn't came out in a slur.
"Couldn't. I just gave Van the go-ahead to let Fitzroy, Sorley, and a couple of others make super coffee in the kitchen. Essentially a form of crank."
"Say what?" Coates spoke with deliberate care, reminding Clint of how drunk spoke when they were trying to appear sober.
"According to Van, who got it from Angel, our own Walter White, our coffee is light roast instead of dark, which is good because it has more caffeine. Then, instead of one bag per pot, they're gonna use three. Gonna make gallons."
She looked surprised and licked her lips.
"Gallons, I mean. My lips feel all numb."
"Are you kidding?" He didn't know if he was talking about the coffee or her lips.
"Oh, you haven't heard the best part, Doc. They're gonna dump all the Sudafed from the infirmary into the coffee, and we've got quite a stock. But before they drink the coffee, the inmates have to chug a mixture of grapefruit juice and butter. Speeds up the absorption. That's what Angel claims, and I don't see the harm."
Coates tried to get up and fell back into her chair with a little laugh. Clint hurried to her side. Jan, have you been drinking? She stared at him, eyes glassy.
No, of course not. This isn't like being drunk. This is like...
She blinked and reached out to touch a small leather bag beside the in-out basket on her desk. Coates patted it with the tips of her fingers, feeling for something.
My pills? They were here on the desk in my clutch.
What pills? What are you taking? Clint looked for a bottle but saw nothing on the desk. He bent and looked beneath. Nothing but a few dust bunnies left behind by the last trustee who had cleaned the place.
Jan, ah, fuck.
She lolled back in her chair.
Going bye-bye, Doc. Going sleep.
Clint looked in the wastebasket, and there, among some tissues and a few crumpled Mars bar wrappers, he found a brown prescription bottle. The label said Janice Coates and Xanax and 10 milligrams. It was empty. He held it up so Janice could see it, and they spoke the same word at the same time, Coates slurring her half of the duet. Peters. Making an effort, surely a supreme effort, Janice Coates sat up and fixed Clint's gaze with her own. Though her eyes were glassy, when she spoke, she was hardly slurring at all.
Get him, Doc, before he leaves the building. Slam that molesting son of a bitch into a C-wing cell and throw away the key.
You need to vomit, Clint said. Raw eggs. I'll get some from the kit.
Too late. I'm going down. Tell Mickey.
Her eyes closed. She forced them open again.
Tell Mickey I love her.
You'll tell her that yourself. Coates smiled. Her eyelids were rolling down again.
You're in charge now, Doc. At least until Hicks comes back. Yeah.
She uttered a huge sigh.
Keep them safe until they all go to sleep. And then, keep them safe. Keep us safe until...
Warden Coates crossed her arms on her desk blotter and pillowed her head on them. Clint watched in fascination and horror as the first strands of white began to spin out of her hair, her ears, and the skin of her flushed cheeks. So fast, he thought. So goddamn fast. He hurried from the office, meaning to tell Coates' secretary to get on the horn and make sure Peters was kept on site, but Blanche McIntyre was gone. Lying on her blotter was a single piece of prison stationery with a note written on it in black Sharpie. Clint read the big block letters twice before he could believe what his eyes told him he was seeing.
I have gone to my book club.
Book club? Book club? Really? Blanche went to her fucking book club? Clint ran down Broadway toward the entrance lobby, dodging a few wandering inmates in their baggy brown tops, aware that some were regarding him with surprise. He got to the locked main doors and hammered on the intercom button until Millie Olson, still on the board at the lobby security station, answered.
Jesus, Doc, don't wear it out. What's wrong?
Through the double glass panes, he could see Don Peters' battered Chevrolet beyond the inner gate, inside the dead zone, but now passing through the outer gate. He could even see Don's stubby fingers holding out his ID card for the reader. Clint pushed the intercom button again and said,
Never mind, Millie. Never mind.
Chapter 13 1 On her way back to town, an impudent little nonsense jingle began to run through Lila Norcross's mind, one she and her friends had chanted when they were down street and their parents couldn't hear. She began to chant it now in the dying daylight.
In Derby Town, the streets are made of glass. In Derby Town, the girls will kick your bumpty-bump, bumpty-bump, bumpty-bumpity-bump-a-bump.
What came next?
Oh, yes. In Derby Town, my brother had a fit. In Derby Town, my sister's full of bumpty-bump, bumpty-bump.
Almost too late, she realized she was off the road and running into the underbrush, bound for a steep slope down which her cruiser would roll at least 3 times before reaching the bottom. She stood both feet on the brake and stopped with the front end of the car hanging over that gravelly drop. She threw the gear shift into park, and as she did, she felt tendrils of something brush gently against her cheeks. She tore at them, had time to see one melting away even as it lay across her palm, then shouldered open her door and tried to get out. Her harness was still on, and it yanked her back. She opened the clasp, got out, and stood taking deep breaths of the air, which was finally cooling. She slapped herself across the face once, then twice. "Close one," she said. Far below, one of the little creeks in the local patois, that fed the Ball River went flowing and chuckling east. "That was a close one, Lila Jean." Too close. She would fall asleep eventually, she knew that, and the white crap would spin itself out of her skin and enclose her when she did. But she would not let that happen until she had kissed and hugged her son at least one more time. That was a dead red promise. She got back behind the wheel and grabbed her mic. "Unit 4, this is Unit 1. Come back." Nothing at first, and she was about to repeat when Terry Coombs replied, "1, this is 4. He sounded wrong, somehow, as if he had a cold. "4, have you checked the drugstores?" "Yeah, 2 looted, 1 on fire. FD is on the seed, so it won't spread. I guess that's one good thing. The pharmacist at the CVS was shot dead, and we think there's at least one body inside the Rite Aid. That's the one that's burning. FD doesn't know how many Vicks for sure." "Oh, no. Sorry, Chief. It's true." No, not as if he had a cold, as if he'd been crying. "Terry, what is it? Something else is wrong." "Went home," he said. "Found Rita covered in that cocoon crap. She nodded off at the table, just like she always does before I come home from my shift. Grabbed 15 or 20 minutes for herself. I warned her not to, and she said she wouldn't, and then I zipped home to see how she was doing, and..." Now he did begin to cry. "So I put her in bed, and I came back out to check the drugstores, like you said. What else could I do? I tried calling my daughter, and there's no answer in her room. Rita tried calling, too, early, a bunch of times." Diana Coombs was a freshman in college at USC. Her father made a gaspy, watery sound. "Most of the West Coast women are asleep, never woke up. I hoped maybe she was up all night, studying or something, partying even, but I know she's not, Lila." "Maybe you're wrong." Terry ignored this. "But hey, they're breathing, right? All the women and girls are still breathing. So maybe, I don't know." "Is Roger with you?" "No. I spoke with him, though. He found Jessica covered with it, head to toe. Must have gone to sleep naked, because she looks like a mummy in one of those old horror movies. Baby, too. Right there in the crib, wrapped up, same as the ones they've been showing on television. Roger lost it. He was bawling and howling his damn head off. I tried to get him to come with me, but he wouldn't." This made Lila unreasonably angry, probably because she was so goddamn wrung out herself. If she wasn't allowed to give up, then no one else was either. "It'll be night soon, and we're going to need every cop we've got." "I told him that. I'll go get Roger. Meet me at the station, Terry. Tell everyone you can reach to join us. 7 o'clock. "Why?" Even with the world going to hell in a handbasket, Lila would not put that out over the air. But they were going to break into the evidence locker and have a nice little drug party. Uppers only. "Just be there." "I don't think Roger will come." "He will, even if I have to handcuff him." She backed away from the drop she'd almost gone over and headed into town. She was using her light bar, but still paused at every intersection, because with everything that was happening, jackpot lights might not be enough. By the time she reached Richland Lane, where Roger and Jessica Elway lived, that damn little earworm was going through her head again. In Derby Town, when your daddy's got an itch." A Datsun trundled slowly across her path, ignoring both her flashing lights and the four-way stop at the intersection. On an ordinary day, she would have been on the careless son of a bitch like white on rice. If she hadn't been fighting sleep, she might have even noticed the bumper sticker on the back deck, "What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding," and identified it as belonging to Mrs. Ransom, who lived just up the street and a little way down from where all those unoccupied houses were. Had she been wide awake, she surely would have recognized the driver as her son, and the passenger beside him as Mary Pack, the girl he was so crazy about. But it wasn't an ordinary day, and she was far from wide awake, so she continued onward to the Elway house on Richland Lane, where she found herself in the next act of that day's continuing nightmare. 2. Jared Norcross had an earworm of his own, but it had nothing to do with Derbytown, where the streets were made of glass. It was coincidence, serendipity, predestination, fate. Pick one or pick none, it was probably all the same to the universe. Coincidence, serendipity, predestination, fate. "You blew that stop sign," Mary said, temporarily breaking the spell. "And I saw a cop." "Don't tell me that," Jared said. He was upright behind the wheel, sweating, his speeding heart sending bolts of pain directly to his hurt knee. He could still flex the knee, which made him believe he hadn't actually torn anything, just sprained it, but it was badly swollen and aching. The idea of getting bagged by a cop when he had no legal right to drive, at least not without a licensed driver beside him, was a nasty one. His mother had told him time and again that the worst thing for her, as chief of police, would be if he got picked up for anything illegal. Anything. Even so much as walking out of Fenton's newsstand with a candy bar he'd forgotten to pay for. "And believe me," Lyle had said, "if it's the worst thing for me, I'll make it the worst thing for you." Mrs. Ransom's granddaughter, Molly, was perched on her knees in the back seat, looking out the rear window.
"No problem," she reported. 5-0 went right across.
Jared relaxed a little, but he still couldn't believe he was doing this. Less than half an hour ago, he had been at home, waiting for the next word from one of his parents. Then he called Mary, who started shouting at him before he could get three words beyond hello.
"Where are you? I've been trying to get you for years."
"You have? This might not be too bad. A girl didn't shout like that unless she cared, did she?" "My cell phone's broken."
"Well, get over here. I need help."
"What do you need? What's wrong?"
"You know what's wrong. Everything, if you're a girl."
She caught her breath and brought it down a notch.
"I need a ride to Shopwell. If my dad were here, I'd ask him, but he's in Boston for work, and he's trying to get home, but that doesn't do us any good right now."
Shopwell was the town's big supermarket, but it was on the far side of town. He had adopted his most reasonable adult voice. "Dueling Grocery is a lot closer to where you are, Mary. I know it doesn't have the best selection.
Will you listen?"
He fell silent, scared by the controlled hysteria in her voice.
"It has to be Shopwell, because there's this woman who works there in the produce section. A lot of the kids know about her. She sells study aids."
"Are you talking about speed?" Silence. "Mary, that stuff is illegal."
"I don't care. My mom's okay for now, but my little sister's only 12. Her bedtime's at 9, and she's usually a zombie even before then."
"And there's you," Jared had thought.
"Plus, there's me. I don't want to go to sleep. I don't want to go into a cocoon. I'm scared to fucking death."
"I get that," Jared said.
"Oh, no, you don't. You're a guy. No guy can understand."
She drew in a deep, wet breath.
"Never mind. I don't know why I waited to hear from you. I'll call Eric."
"Don't do that," Jared said, panicked.
"I'll come and get you." "You will? Really?"
Oh, God, the gratitude. It had weakened his knees.
"Yes." "Your parents won't mind?"
"No," Jared said, which wasn't precisely untrue. How could they mind if he never told them? They probably would have minded a lot, of course, even putting aside, you know, the world crisis, because Jared didn't have a driver's license. He would have had it if he hadn't bumped a trash can while trying to parallel park during his first test. Up to then, everything had been going fine. Had Jared given Mary the impression that he had actually passed the test? Well, only insofar as that Jared had told her he had. Damn it, the lie had seemed harmless at the time. It seemed so dorky to have failed the test. He was scheduled to take it again next month, and since he didn't have his own car anyway, she'd never know. That had been his logic. Somehow, Jared didn't think driver's license exams were going to be a priority in Doolin County for a while. Or anywhere.
"How long will it take you to get here?"
15 minutes, 20 at the most. Just wait for me." It was only after he hung up that he realized how far ahead of himself he'd gotten. Not only did he have no driver's license, he had no car. His father had taken the Prius to the prison, and his mom's Toyota was parked behind the police station. In terms of vehicles, the Norcross cupboard was bare. Either he had to borrow some wheels, or he had to call Mary back and tell her to let Eric drive her after all. The former alternative seemed unlikely, but after all that had gone on this afternoon, the latter was unthinkable. That was when the doorbell had rung. Coincidence, serendipity, predestination, fate. 3. Mrs. Ransom had been hunched over a hospital cane and wearing a cruel-looking metal brace on her right leg. Seeing her thus made Jared, even in his current predicament, feel that he had been taking his own sprained knee far too seriously.
"I saw you come home," Mrs. Ransom said.
"Jared, isn't it?"
"Yes, ma'am."
Jared, a boy who would have remembered his manners even on the sinking Titanic, held out his hand, scraped from his earlier run through the underbrush. Mrs. Ransom smiled and shook her head.
"I better not. Arthritis. And you must excuse me if I skip the amenities, which I ordinarily would never do, but time is of the essence this evening, it seems. Young man, do you have a driver's license?"
Jared found himself remembering some movie where the suave villain had said, "You can only hang me once."
"Yes, but I don't have a car."
"That is not a problem. I have one. It's a Datsun, old but in excellent repair. I drive it seldom these days because of my arthritis. Also, my leg brace makes it difficult to operate the pedals. I make my customers pick up from the house. They're usually okay with that. Oh, never mind. It's not relevant, is it? Jared, I need a favor."
Jared was quite sure he knew what the requested favor was going to be.
"I sleep badly these days under the best of circumstances, and since my granddaughter came to stay with me while my son and daughter-in-law work out their differences, I've hardly slept at all. I have gone in debt to sleep, you might say, and in spite of all my painful ailments, I believe that tonight that debt may be called in. Unless, that is..."
She raised her cane so she could scratch the spot between her eyebrows.
"Oh, this is hard. I am ordinarily a private person, a decorous person, not one to spill my problems on a complete stranger. But I saw you arrive home, and I thought perhaps you thought I might know someone, be able to get something that would help you stay awake a little while longer."
He spoke it as a statement, not a question, thinking coincidence, serendipity, predestination, fate. Mrs. Ransom's eyes had widened.
"Oh, no, not at all. I know someone. At least I think I do. All I've ever purchased from her is marijuana. It helps my arthritis and my glaucoma. But I do believe she sells other things. And it isn't just me. There's Molly to think about, my granddaughter. She's as lively as a flea right now, but by 10 o'clock she'll be..."
"Getting soupy," Jared said, thinking of Mary's sister.
"Yes. Will you help me? The woman's name is Norma Bradshaw. She works at the Shopwell store, on the other side of town, in the produce section."
4. Now here he was, driving to Shopwell on his permit with one traffic violation, a blown stop sign, already to his credit, and the lives of two people in his inexperienced hands. Mary, he had been counting on, 10-year-old Molly Ransom, not so much. She had already been sitting in the elderly Datsun's back seat when Jared assisted her grandmother back to the house, and Mrs. Ransom insisted that he take the girl. Getting out of the house would help keep the poor mite's juices flowing. The news report said that there was unrest in the cities, but Mrs. Ransom wasn't the least bit concerned about sending her granddaughter on an errand in little old Dueling. Jared was in no position to refuse an extra passenger. The car belonged to the old lady, after all, and if he refused in spite of that, it might raise that pertinent question again. He was a licensed driver, wasn't he? Mrs. Ransom might let him go even if he admitted the truth. She was pretty desperate, but he didn't want to take the risk. They were at last approaching the supermarket, thank God. Molly was sitting down again with her seatbelt fastened,
but she had a motor mouth, and it was currently in high gear. So far, Jared and Mary had learned that Molly's best friend was Olive, and Olive could be a puke when she didn't get her own way. It was like her superpower, except who would even want it? And Molly's parents were seeing a marriage counselor, and Graham smoked special medicine because it helped her eyes and her arthritis. And she had a great big smoker thing with an American Eagle on it. And usually smoking was bad, but it was different for Graham, although Molly wasn't supposed to talk about that because then people might think smoking that wasn't okay.
Molly, Mary said, do you ever shut up?
Usually just when I'm sleeping, Molly said.
I don't want you to go to sleep, but your thoughts are a little overwhelming. Also, you should stop breathing your grandmother's pot smoke. It's not good for you.
Fine.
Molly folded her arms across her chest.
Can I just ask one thing, Miss Bossy Mary?
I suppose, Mary said.
Her hair, usually pulled back smoothly and tied in a ponytail, was loose on her shoulders. Jared thought she looked beautiful.
Are you guys boyfriend and girlfriend?
Mary looked at Jared and opened her mouth to say something. Before she could, he dared to take one hand off the wheel and point ahead at a huge parking lot bathed in a bowl of halogen light. It was crammed with cars.
Shopwell ahoy!
5.
This is crazy, Mary said.
Crazy, crazy, Molly agreed.
Jared parked on the grass at the far end of the Shopwell lot. That was probably another violation, but not one that would count for much when the lot itself was a demo derby. Cars sped recklessly up and down the few lanes that were still clear, honking at shoppers who were wheeling full carts. As they surveyed the scene, two carts collided and the men pushing them started yelling at each other. Maybe you better stay in the car, Molly.
No way,
she seized Jared's hand.
You're not leaving me, either of you. Please, my mother left me in a parking lot once and...
Come on then,
Mary said. She pointed to one of the middle lanes.
Let's go that way. Less chance of getting run down.
The three of them weaved through a snarl of abandoned automobiles. They had just passed one of these orphans when a Dodge Ram pickup backed out of its space and struck it, driving it backward until there was enough room to escape. The Ram roared past them, its newly dented tailgate flapping like a loose jaw. Inside, Shopwell was pandemonium. Voices babbled, voices roared. There were screams and the sound of breaking glass. Men were yelling. As they hung back beside the stacks of shopping baskets and the few remaining carts, a skinny man in a suit coat and tie went sprinting past, pushing a cart full of Red Bull, Blasto Cola, and Monster Energy drinks. Chasing after him was a burly guy in jeans and a t-shirt, stomping in motorcycle boots.
You can't have all of those, Motorcycle Boots shouted.
First come, first serve.
Suit coat and tie shouted back without turning.
First come, first serve.
He tried a hard right into aisle 7, pet food and paper products, but weight and momentum carried his overloaded cart into a display of dog cookies. They went flying. Motorcycle Boots was on the cart at once, grabbing 6 packs of energy drink. When Suit coat and tie tried to reclaim his cart, Boots shoved him. Suit coat went down. Jared looked at Mary.
Where's produce? I've never been in here before.
Over there, I think.
She pointed to the left. He carried Molly on his back, stepping over Suit Coat, who was propped on one hand and rubbing his head with the other.
The guy was crazy, he said to Jared. All that over some energy drinks.
I know. Not stating the obvious, which was Suit Coat and Ty had been trying to escape with a shitload of same.
Everyone is crazy. What do they think it is? A hurricane? A fucking snowstorm?
He glanced at Molly and said, Excuse me.
Oh, don't worry. My parents say that all the time,
Molly said. She clung to Jared even tighter. Fish and meat, running all along the back wall, was relatively calm, but aisle 4, vitamins, health supplements, and pain relievers, was a war zone. Battle had raged for the brown bottles of Genestra, Lumiday, Natrol, and half a dozen other over-the-counter brands. The middle shelves were completely stripped, and Jared guessed that was where the supplements designed to promote wakefulness had been. An elderly lady in a blue-patterned muumuu hustled up the aisle toward them, pursued by J.T. Whitstock, the coach of the football team and father of two of Jared's mother's deputies, Will and Roop Whitstock.
Jared didn't know the coach to speak to, but at the department's Labor Day party, Will and Roop had won the sack race and then nearly had a fistfight over who got to keep the $5 trophy. Lila, ever diplomatic about her crew and their families, described them as very young and very energetic. The Moomoo lady was slowed by her shopping basket, which was filled with bottles of something called Vitacaf. Coach Whitstock grabbed her by the collar of her dress and hauled her backward. Her basket went flying and the bottles scattered, several rolling toward Jared, Mary, and Molly.
No, she shouted. No, please, we can share. We can
You scarfed up everything that was left, Coach Whitstock snarled. You call that sharing? I need some of these for my wife. The coach and the Moomoo lady grubbed on the floor after the bottles. He shoved her into one of the shelves, sending down a cascade of aspirin cartons.
You bully, she cried. You big, mean bully.
Jared stepped forward without thinking about it, put his foot on top of Coach Whitstock's balding head and drove it sideways. Coach Whitstock went sprawling. The lady began to refill her basket. Coach crouched behind her for a moment, three-point stance, eyes shifting from side to side. The tread of Jared's sneaker was faintly printed on his pate. Then he sprang forward and snatched the half-filled basket with the spry athleticism of a monkey stealing an orange. He sprinted past Jared, sparing him a stink-eye glare that said, "I'll remember your face, bud," bumping his shoulder and sending him spinning down with Molly still on his back. They hit the floor and Molly wailed. Mary started toward them. Jared shook his head. "We're all right. Make sure she is." Looking at the Moomoo lady, who was gathering up the few bottles of Vitacaf Coach Whitstock had missed. Mary dropped to one knee.
"Ma'am, are you okay?"
"I think so," she said. "Just shaken up. Why would that man... I suppose he said he had a wife, maybe a daughter, but I also have a daughter."
Her purse had ended up halfway down the littered aisle. It was ignored by the shoppers squabbling over the few remaining bottles of supplements. Jared helped Molly up and returned the purse to the lady. She put the Vitacaf bottles inside.
"I shall pay for these another day," she said. And as Mary assisted her to her feet, "Thank you. I shop here all the time, and some of these people are my neighbors, but I don't know any of them tonight."
She limped away, holding her purse tight against her chest.
"I want to go back to Graham's,"
Molly cried.
"You get the stuff," Mary said to Jared. "Her name is Norma, and she's got a lot of frizzy blonde hair. I'll take Molly back to the car."
"I know. Mrs. Ransom told me," Jared said.
"Be careful."
She moved away, leading Molly by the hand, and then turned back.
"If she's reluctant to sell to you, tell her that Eric Blass sent you. That might help."
She must have seen the hurt in his eyes, because she gave a little wince before half running for the front of the store, bent protectively over the frightened girl.